so to speak. So tonight's theme, then, will allow us to plumb the depths of an ancient problem and move forward to talking about the difficulties that we face right now with respect to American democracy. So let me tell you something that you should take to heart. I know you all believe that it is love that makes the world go round. That's not true. It is leadership. Leadership makes the world go round, not love, because love is merely a private transaction between two or more people. And history is a transaction that deals with, leadership is a public transaction that reaches across centuries and involves the masses. And in fact, leadership is in fact the ability to inspire and to mobilize the masses for what leaders perceive to be good policies, programs, and laws, which in fact American citizens may not yet glimpse or may not recognize or may not believe are necessary. And so the reality is that leaders have to sell a vision. And it's not the easiest thing to do, to sell a vision and to encourage people to abandon that which has existed. Because, in fact, as you know, people are quite wedded to precedent. People are quite wedded to convention. We don't lightly abandon that which we've done for a period of time, particularly those things that we've embraced, those practices and programs, for many, many years. And so a leader has to be a visionary. More than that, a leader has to be able to articulate a message, to sell a vision. And in fact, leaders have to be particularly good with the language, because in a democracy, the peculiarities of a democracy, I should say, require that leaders can communicate ideas. And particularly because in a system where we like to believe that we engage in discussion and debate and government by reflection, the words that are used are going to be very important. Because at rock bottom, in a democracy, we seek consent. No leader can go forward very far without achieving consent. And if, in fact, we take to heart the very essence of democracy, which is to say we believe we are a government based on the consent of the people, it would simply be inappropriate and also illegitimate for government to try to hoodwink the people, to fool the people, to lie to the people, because that would be fraud. That would be perpetrating a fraud on the American people. When we talk about the very important idea of government based on the consent of the people, that means we want transparency. We want to hear what governmental leaders have to say. We want to hear their rationales, their reasoning for engaging in certain programs and policies. Anything less, to the extent that there's extreme ambiguity, or there is dissembling, or there's misinformation coming out of any branch of government, that is the perpetuation of a fraud upon the sovereign people, who have every right to know the rationales and the reasoning behind governmental actions, policies, and words. So when we start with that background, let's understand that in the modern era of democracy, which we would say begins roughly in the 17th century, is that okay for a modern period? When we talk about the modern period of democracy, we start with the writings of John Locke, the great English philosopher, whom you may know wrote a very important book published in 1691 called The Second Treatise of Government, in which he explained the emergence of the democratic doctrine. The democratic doctrine emerged in the context of the English civil wars in the mid-17th century. And the democratic doctrine essentially went to war with the divine right of kingship. That marked the emergence of the modern doctrine of democracy, which is to say that until the English Civil Wars in England, kings had told their peoples that they sat on the throne by virtue of God's anointment. And any challenges to the king meant that you were challenging God, and that would be heresy. If you challenged God and committed heresy, then you could be doomed for all eternity. And eternity, as they say, lasts a long time. So those who found the courage to challenge the kingship through democratic doctrine recognized right away what they were doing was to exalt the very concept of an omnipotent people against an omnipotent king. The idea that the people were as wise as the king, capable of carrying out the very same actions as the king, and that their rights ought to be recognized, because their claim to rights were born in the doctrine of natural rights, bestowed by the same God whom the king had invoked to justify all-powerful rule by a single monarch. So it took a lot of courage for writers in the mid-17th century during the Civil War to assert that the divine right of kingship was fraudulent, that the real stuff was to be found in the doctrine of natural rights, because God had created people, all people equally, had endowed them with certain inalienable rights such as life, liberty, and property. And those rights would be asserted against the divine right of kingship. And of course, in the midst of the Civil War, the king lost. And that meant that the doctrine of the divine right of kingship was buried, and the doctrine of natural rights was now going full steam ahead. And the reality is, once it had been unleashed, the people were not going to allow it to be turned back. What that meant, John Locke said in the Second Treatise of Government, was that when the people believe that their rights have been violated in a serious way, that they have a right to revolt, they have a right to overthrow government, the decision to engage in the revolution against government would not be an individual decision per se, but it might be a spontaneous combustion of all the people deciding that their rights had been trampled, that the government was no longer representing their interest, and that because they were sovereign, they had the right to retake their government. This marked then the claim that not only would people have a right to govern themselves, but in fact that the people would not accept nonsense from governments going forward. They would not accept the idea that leaders could dictate to the popular groups, that they could not dictate to the populace or the sovereign people, but in fact leaders would have to be held accountable to the people. This would be turning history on its head. It would be turning history on its head, because always before this point, the people had to be accountable to the kingship. Now, with this historic change, the government had to be accountable to the people. This meant then, from this point forward, people would view government with suspicion, because the people had a right to expect a certain level of competence. They had a certain right to expect that their rights to life, liberty, and property would be protected. And at all events, if the government failed, then the people would have the right to overthrow the government. These doctrines emerging from the Whiggish writers in the mid-17th century in England never took hold, but they did find a foundation across the Atlantic in America. And Americans embraced those writings, lock, stock, and barrel, so that they would now have an intellectual foundation for challenging governmental actions, programs, and policies. And at the bottom of their newfound beliefs was that government should be viewed with suspicion, and that would lead our founding fathers to say, among other things, that government is best which governs least. Government should have no more power than that which is absolutely necessary to govern. And at all events, the government would be accountable not only to the people, but to the Constitution. Suddenly now, government would be straitjacketed. Government would not be able to stray beyond the confines of authority granted to it by the American people, because only through the maintenance of those confines, only through the maintenance of those limitations on governmental power, could the people believe that, in fact, they would be in charge, that the government would be accountable to the sovereign people. So with that understanding, Americans were now in the grip of a brand new concept of leadership. And they would begin to debate what constituted good leadership, what was required of leaders in a democracy. James Madison wrote in Federalist 37 about the importance of words in a democracy, because the words spoken by leaders, the words set forth in documents, would represent the signposts of those who possess governmental authority, and that those words should be written with transparency so that the American people would understand what their government was up to. And that introduced the importance of the peculiarity of language in American democracy. As I said before, there was the very clear expectation that governmental leaders should speak clearly to the American people and be willing to be held accountable for their views and their values. That meant that there was a duality of expectation here. On the one hand, there was the history-old understanding that the people would have to follow governmental leadership, but there was the new element that government could not lead without the consent of the people. And so this would introduce a very different dynamic than that which had prevailed over the centuries. And so there emerged great tension between the people and the government, and that raised a number of new issues. What do we mean by representation? When should our representatives follow our views? When, if under any circumstances, do representatives have a right to ignore the will of the people? If so, what will the consequences be? And where do we draw a line between the concept that governmental representatives should draw upon their own expertise, their own knowledge in making decisions, and those circumstances in which whatever they thought, they had an obligation to obey the will of the people? All of these questions would inspire great tension. That led Thomas Jefferson, among others, to indicate that in American democracy, there was the responsibility of the government to the governed, and that however we cut it, the government could never exceed the will of the people, otherwise the people would have a right to revolt. And so those thoughts, which we recognize were stated clearly in the Declaration of Independence, sowing the seeds of potential rebellion at any point in time, would serve to restrain governmental officials. There emerged very early on in the 1780s and the 1790s a great deal of discussion about what we expect of our leaders in a democracy. Not only was there discussion about the responsibility of government to obey the Constitution and to be accountable to the people, but there was also a question of what do we mean by the ability of leaders to inspire the people? How far can governmental leaders go to inspire the American people to follow the actions and the policies set forth by government? This literature, which is very fascinating, suggested, among other things, that there is a, what Jefferson called, a natural aristocracy. Not an aristocracy based on wealth or connection, but a natural aristocracy based on virtue and talent. And as he wrote in letters to his fellow founders, what we want to do is to help everybody understand that we are better off if that natural aristocracy rises to the top. That, in fact, those people who are better equipped for government, those who want the challenge of wielding power in a difficult situation, even in a crisis, those who are willing to articulate a vision for the country, should, in fact, be the very people who are holding leadership positions. He despised the fact that in European countries and in England, that, in fact, an aristocracy governed, an aristocracy that was not in power by virtue of virtue or talent or skills, but an aristocracy based on money and inheritance and wealth, because he thought that practice would pervert the goal of establishing good, efficient government that could promote the happiness of the people. If there is to be a natural aristocracy, Jefferson said, and he believed that there was, then that raised the question, have we always had a natural aristocracy? Has it been the case across history, across the centuries, that in every country there has been a natural aristocracy? Jefferson said, well, not often enough. Most of the time, the wealthy ruled, but there was the expectation that in a democracy we should have that natural aristocracy in power by virtue of their knowledge, their skills, their talents. The question would arise how to ensure that those people are in power and not individuals who don't have an interest in promoting democracy. And that led other founders then to wonder, what happens if we have the wrong sort of person in power, a person looking to line his pockets, a person looking to expand his own authority, a person, the founders wondered, who was filled with greed and did not have anything more in his heart than the expansion of his own empire. That would be the sort of person, the founders concluded, that would not promote democracy. The sort of person who would promote democracy would be that person who would believe in expanding the liberty of the people and lifting ceilings, helping people to achieve their dreams. Those thoughts about what leadership required then would hold fast in America for many, many years, and we could depart from that point for a moment to say that our neighbor across the Atlantic in the 20th century, Winston Churchill, believed with the American founders that the responsibility of government was, in fact, to improve the quality of life for those people who lived during their own time. So the leader would say to himself, Churchill wrote, that my greatest duty is to make sure that the people are better fed and that they're able to pursue their own happiness, and that no principle, no doctrine would get in the way of trying to achieve that goal. That's what would help to determine what constitutes a good leader. And that's what the American founders believe, that in fact, short steps of progress, integrating new policies and programs, would be preferable to a revolution, even though they themselves had engaged in revolution. But it's one thing to say you believe in revolution if you're a revolutionary trying to overthrow an unpopular government, as the colonists believed England was. It's another when you hold power, you no longer espouse the doctrine of revolution. Now, small steps are better. But there is wisdom, the founders believed, in smaller steps. And that goes to the fact that any changes have to be based on the consent of the people. Because if you have a change that is too radical, too dramatic or too radical, then it could tear at the fibers of democracy and might even deprive the people of their freedom. But what lies at the basis of this doctrine of small steps is a philosophical understanding of the great difficulty involved in changing people's minds. Philosophers from Plato and Aristotle all the way through the founders, including Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton, on into the 20th century, whether we're talking about Churchill or we're talking about any number of writers, including Tolstoy, or we're talking about economists, including the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter, who was a well-known philosopher, all aimed at the difficulty of trying to change the minds of the people. What accounts for this difficulty? Machiavelli, who was not embraced by democratic leaders for obvious reasons, because he wrote clearly about the idea that the ends should justify the means, could never be embraced by Democrats, but there was wisdom in what he wrote in explaining that if you try to change policy in any government, you are going to be confronted by enemies. Those people who have a personal stake in current policies, a personal stake defined by their own economic interest, or their own personal interest, or their own great desire to maintain or to acquire more power. Those people will be among the most reluctant to permit any change. And then you'll encounter enemies who will say, I'm scared to go forward with a new idea, because even if what we live under now is not so great, it is at least tolerable, because the devil we know is better than the devil we do not know. And so Machiavelli, ever the great observer of human nature, could say, you'll be damned if you do or you don't. But if you do try to make a change, beware, it will be very difficult to find any supporters. With that in mind, one wonders how we could ever make any change in any government anywhere, particularly in America. And so the quality of leadership defined by a strong observer of the French Revolution said, here are the qualities that a leader in a democracy, an American democracy, for example, must inhabit. That leader must be an observer, must have skills of observation which will allow that leader to properly understand and to identify the circumstances as they exist, not circumstances conjured up by imaginations. That person must also have the skill known as reflection, the ability to draw a connection between that which is being observed and the consequences of potential change. That is, having the habit of a reflective mind, being able to think a little deeply about the implications of a potential change. A third quality would be, in fact, imagination itself, the ability to create a new set of circumstances, a new policy or program that would improve the quality of life, that would enhance the happiness of the American people. And among a couple of others, there would be finally judgment, the ability of a leader to make the determination that, in fact, these steps are necessary, because without change, then the nation will be stuck in the muck and mire of whatever particular problem is surrounding or engulfing the nation. Now, if you think about those qualities of leadership set forth by an observer of the French Revolution in 1789, the qualities of observation and reflection and imagination and judgment at a minimum, how many people come to mind in the history of American government who would embody those necessary traits. I'll let you think about that for a second. Set against the argument that important individuals at any particular time can make a difference is the historical doctrine called determinism, which denies the importance of any individual. Determinism can come in many different shapes and forms, and in fact, determinism has carried a lot of weight across history. Consider, for example, the determinism based on class, perhaps set forth most conspicuously and famously by Karl Marx, the great communist writer who was so effective that they called communism Marxism. That's how you know if you make an impact, by the way. They named the doctrine after you. Marx had said, looking across the scope of human history for centuries, that in fact everything is determined by class. If you have money and if you have connections, then you will in fact have opportunities and advantages. If you're among the poor, then forget about it. And so he would, of course, call for a revolution. That is determinism based on class. But as you all know, there is determinism based on race as well. This would be most conspicuously attached to the Nazis and Adolf Hitler, setting forth the idea that there are superior people and inferior creatures, and the inferior creatures should be eradicated, and that history dictates that the superior races will emerge, just as Karl Marx would say in his view of history, that history will determine that, in fact, ultimately, the proletariat or the poor will engage in a revolution and overthrow capitalism. Others in different traditions of determinism would say individuals do not matter, that history has its own aims, as if history is guided by an impersonal force. Even Tolstoy, the famous Russian author, in his little bitty novel called War and Peace, would, in effect, ask the question, why did these people, without any apparent reason, maraud across Europe, killing their fellow human beings, and could never explain why they were doing it? Tolstoy's character said, the Great War happened because it had to happen. That, in other words, it would not make a difference who was in power at a particular time, who enjoyed a particular office at a particular time. The forces of determinism are at play, and it doesn't matter who lives in or occupying a position at any particular point in time. But those who have argued against the forces of an impersonal determinism make the argument that who is in power at any particular time can make all the difference in the world. This so-called great man theory, promoted by some historians, has been scoffed at by perhaps an equal number of historians across the centuries. But let me ask you this question, and giving you a chance to ponder whether you believe that who is in power at a particular time can make a difference in the course of human events. Let me give you two scenarios. In December of 1931, a British politician was in New York City, walking down Park Avenue, attempting to cross between 76th and 77th Street. He looked the wrong way and was hit by an automobile. He said afterward, I don't know how I was not smashed to pieces like a gooseberry, but I'm glad I wasn't. 14 months later, an American politician was traveling in an open car in a parade in Miami. An assassin's bullet flew toward the car, missed the politician, but struck his passenger, killing his passenger. I wonder, would the world have looked any different for the next two decades. If Winston Churchill had been killed in the automobile accident, or if FDR had been shot dead by the assassin's bullet, would Chamberlain or Lord Halifax have been able to rally the Brits in 1940? Would John Gardner or somebody else have been able to put together the New Deal program and the Four Freedoms program? I think when you take a look at the theory about who is in power at a particular time, that it's fair and it's reasonable to conclude that those people in power, those people in leadership positions at a particular time, can make all the difference in the world. Why might that be? Because they're possessed of those leadership qualities. They embody observation and reflection and some creativity and imagination. They're able, in effect, to articulate a vision for a people. They're able to communicate that vision. They're able to persuade people to embrace those new policies and programs. When we have those kinds of leaders, and they don't come along very often, that's when we see sweeping changes in any given country, or we see an outcome in world events, whether it's a war or foreign policy or sweeping changes in domestic policy, that we would look back upon years later and say, Churchill made the difference. FDR made the difference. And it's not the case that anybody else could have accomplished that. Indeed, the ultimate way to test the thesis of determinism is to ask, if we look at Stratford-on-Avon, would it be the case that if Shakespeare had not been born in that year, that somebody else would have been born and written those great works? Would we say that? That's what determinism holds. Or that some other mother would have given birth to somebody with the same artistic literary skills as Churchill, as Shakespeare or any other great artist. So I think that if we agree that who sits in power, who's in office at a particular time, can make a great difference in world affairs, then we want to ask ourselves, how do we go about finding leadership in America, in American democracy, in times of crisis or difficulties? And we would ask the associated question, do we have that kind of leadership now? And if not, why not? Now, this is not a very easy question to address or to answer, but let us try based on what we've discussed to this point. We know that some great American leaders were terribly ambitious people. To this extent, let me just shorten the description and say, so far, some great American leaders, principally men, have been terribly ambitious. They have, for example, felt that they needed to participate in government, that they had something to offer, and that they should not be banned from the opportunity of serving in a very important governmental post, even if they themselves had suffered setbacks along the way, which would undermine public confidence in their ability to lead. What possesses a man or a woman to believe that he or she has the right stuff and can lead? If we look at the career of Abraham Lincoln, for example, there was nothing in his early years that would have suggested much of anything to others to say, well, old Abraham ought to be president of the United States. He had suffered repeated business failures, had filed bankruptcy several times. He had not distinguished himself. Certainly nothing in his background would have suggested what Jefferson called a natural aristocracy, and even an unnatural aristocracy. He didn't have money. He didn't have connections to powerful people. But he had a fervent belief that he had ideas as the country, as his lifetime rolled along, and he observed the difficulties and the challenges confronting the country. He simply believed that he had ideas that made sense, that reflected a degree of logic and were reasonable, and he believed in himself. He believed in himself. He thought he would have the right stuff, he could communicate policies, and that he ought to be in a decision-making responsibility. Or to go back years before that, to take one opportunity to invoke yet again the great Broadway play involving Alexander Hamilton's life. Why did Hamilton ever have such self-confidence given his impoverished circumstances, coming to America as an immigrant, scaling the Great Wall so he could come to America and assume an important position? Possessed of confidence, self-confidence, believed in himself. Or Bill Clinton, to move forward a couple of centuries, born into poverty in Arkansas, suffered through a miserable childhood. Why did he grow up believing that he could become a defining leader in America, or anybody in between? It is hard to put your finger on why some people believe that they have this self-confidence. Not only that they have the self-confidence, but they have the ability to communicate a message, to sketch a vision, to implement the new policies and programs, to persuade people that change is necessary. Why is it that some people believe that they have those requisite qualities? Psychologists will wrestle with this for many, many years to come. It's not easy to govern. Consider Freud's take on the difficulty of governing. He placed government in the same category alongside education and psychoanalysis and said, these three professions will lead you to understand beforehand that you're only going to achieve unsatisfactory results. A little bit cynical that it's hard to govern, at least it's hard to engage in psychoanalysis, and education, educating the public, forget it. So when we talk about those who have the self-confidence and believe they're possessed of those requisite qualities to lead, we'll continue to wrestle with them. We find in the biographies of people who have succeeded some similar traits, don't we? We find, for example, some very dark qualities grounded in a dark childhood or early upbringing. Consider that many of these people who made a difference in the course of American life believed that they had to prove themselves to one parent or the other. This seems to be a common trait, whether we're talking about Lincoln or FDR or Clinton and certainly Lyndon B. Johnson. All of these people, plus I would say Richard Nixon, who may not have made a difference in a positive way, nevertheless, people who make a difference often spend their lives trying to prove themselves to their parents, which means that they are driven. They are driven, and there is almost a DNA trait in them that they are determined to succeed and satisfy their parents' expectations, or at least the expectation of one parent or another. They also have embodied terrific communication skills. Consider how good Lincoln was at communicating. He did it in a homespun way through great stories and tremendous wit and humor. So, for example, when he was being heckled by a woman in the audience who said, you are homely and you are two-faced. And he looked at her and said, Madam, do you think if I had another face, I would be wearing this one? So that kind of humor was very effective in disarming critics. Bill Clinton had that off-the-cuff wit available on a moment's notice. John Kennedy did, as we know famously. At any rate, humor turned out to be one of those qualities often associated with leadership. And in fact, whom would we say had greater wit than Churchill himself? always on display to disarm opponents. And so we have the driven nature, we have a human quality. All of these people were very, very bright. There is something to be said about high native intelligence that inspires self-confidence. It enables a successful politician then to develop a thick skin, a prerequisite, as you know. It's hard to achieve success in the public life if you don't have a thick skin. So what breeds a thick skin? That tremendous self-confidence is there, but what helps to inspire it? If you're a man or a woman of high intelligence, then you believe that whatever those people say who happen to disagree with you, oh, those poor people, they can't help themselves. They don't know better. And that allows you to fend off the criticisms and the complaints about your positions. There are other qualities as well. We said communication is one. All of these people were good speakers, as I said a second ago, whether it's Lincoln in his homespun way or FDR with his superb communication skills during his radio talks, or certainly Johnson on the stump, who was very, very good. And so we could go on and on to talk about their communication skills. They all, by the way, tend to be good writers, which is an interesting quality. And, of course, they all are willing to suffer losses en route to the high achievement because they believe in one way or another that even if they sustain losses early, they have enough self-confidence that they will reach that higher land where they can succeed in finally putting their own policies in place. American leaders of high quality don't come along very often. And we ask ourselves today, in the midst of this governmental shutdown, why can't we work our way through this shutdown? Well into the second month now, and we understand the White House has asked the various agencies, agency heads, which agencies can be shut down if we're still in a shutdown in April. And that's right, April and May. And how is this even possible, particularly when we ask ourselves that fundamental question about American democracy, can the government govern? And how do we say that the people's government is failing the people? What would John Locke say? What would Thomas Jefferson say in that language reflective of a rebellion or a little rebellion once in a while? What's the problem here? Do we lack leadership? One of the great problems that we suffer from, of course, is that there's a failure of leaders in Washington to find consensus, to engage in compromise. And as we've said before, the engine of democracy is in fact compromise. But as we've discussed at different points when we've met, there is a real reluctance for people on both sides of the aisle to engage in compromise because we've reached a point in which there's such antipathy toward people who are members of the other party. They feel that they are engaging in an act of disloyalty if they reach across the aisle. And in this period of time, when the rhetoric on both sides is at an all-time high as exhibited on radio talk shows, television talk shows, there is a great fear about compromise for fear that you'll be viewed as weak, or that you're insufficiently principled, that you're not loyal to the party, that you're caving in, and you're going to cost the country dearly. When both sides have their heels dug in so firmly, then it becomes very, very difficult to reach the compromise necessary to climb out of this governmental shutdown. On the other hand, what if one side of the shutdown is proposing a policy that is indefensible? Should the other side cave in for the sake of ending the shutdown? In the view of some, should you capitulate to a terrible, expensive policy. Should you do that? That's the question, then, of how a government should best represent the people. Is the government representing the people in an able and competent way if, in fact, there is an unwillingness to reach a compromise even on or over a policy which seems unacceptable to so many people? I leave that for you to consider. When we return ultimately to the question of democracy and leadership, then, we consider that historic tension, which is a necessary ingredient in a democracy, going all the way back, in the first instance, to the concern about even having leaders tell followers what they should do. But we recognize at rock bottom that all governments require leaders. And I said at the outset that a democracy may require leaders or leadership more than any other system. And that's because we believe that in a democracy where everybody has an equal right to express themselves guaranteed by First Amendment freedoms, that in fact the government has a responsibility always to allow those people to air their views, to vent their criticisms, and even if it means that we can't achieve a majority viewpoint on any given issue, that it's necessary for those people to continue to express themselves. That means that if, in fact, the people are going to engage in an act of running in circles, then we're going to have a great deal of difficulty of finding our way out of the problem. It's going to be very, very difficult for governmental leaders to respond to the people without fear of crossing their party leaders. It's going to be very difficult for the American people to persuade governmental leaders to find a consensus when, in fact, the American people themselves have not yet agreed on the best way to achieve a problem like this. Is there some relief to be found in the results of the polls? If you're following the polls, we see that something like 53% of the American people at present are blaming President Trump. The other side, the Democrats, are still blameworthy, Americans believe, but less so. How do we find our way out of this when, in fact, the two principal leaders really loathe one another? So, should we have a State of the Union next week? You may know from the news today that when Speaker Pelosi told President Trump that there would be no State of the Union held in the Capitol until the government governmental shutdown ended and people went back to work, that in fact President Trump said, I don't care what she says, I'm going to go to the Capitol and deliver the State of the Union anyway. To which everybody replied, the State of the Union address in the Capitol comes by invitation. We long ago abandoned the idea that the king could come to Parliament and instruct members of Parliament. So that means that without the passage of a concurrent resolution, that is a resolution approved by both the Senate and the House, there can be no State of the Union delivered in the Capitol. The President, if he wishes, could deliver what he calls a State of the Union address at any other venue, from the Oval Office, from one of his businesses, from a golf course. He could do it wherever he pleases, but it's not going to carry the solemnity of a State of the Union address if it's not delivered to both chambers in the august building known as Congress. Or, if he chose, he could simply send a letter, as many presidents did before Woodrow Wilson introduced the practice of having a president deliver the State of the Union in front of Congress. So we're on a standoff on that point as well. I don't know how this standoff ends. I don't know how we find the shutdown recipe, principally because President Trump has said he's not going to cave in. He so fervently believes in the need for a wall, and his driving ambition for the wall has everything to do with pleasing his base. That is to say, he wants to enjoy the political victory that would come when he could say, when he could declare, I got the wall that I told you I would obtain. They didn't want to give it to me, but we won. He wants that to strengthen his platform, feels very strongly he needs that. Unless President Trump is willing to abandon the wall, I don't see how we end this shutdown. And Nancy Pelosi and Democratic leaders are unwilling to grant the wall. They called the president's bluff today when they introduced a plan that would actually increase the amount of border security that exceeded their previous position, but no wall. So stay tuned on that. In the end, let me conclude by saying the founders of the nation deeply believed that leadership was important. It was critical. But they themselves understood the great difficulty of trying to find leaders who could embody these prerequisites for outstanding leadership. They could not have known in their own lifetime, of course, that they would have many of those leaders, beginning with George Washington, including Thomas Jefferson, and a good many others. Americans will always long for effective leadership in our country, and only once in a while, it seems, will we be so lucky to find such a leader. But if any of you see such a leader, grab her, grab him, and don't let them get away. Thank you. Thanks. So now we come to the truly democratic part of this discussion of democracy and leadership, and I welcome your questions, your challenges, your corrections of everything that I've said. Kelly has the microphone. Park, please.
Thank you, Dave. Another good presentation. Very interesting.
Thank you.
One of the things you didn't mention, but we have relied on for a long time, is statesmen throughout the government, particularly in the Senate or Congress. And I don't know what's happened to the system, whether it's the desire to be reelected, and so you just throw that out. Yeah. What's your view? Where are the statesmen? Why can't we get them?
That is a great question. Of course, that goes hand in hand with the concept of leaders. But you're wise to raise that question of statesmen here in America who might serve in the House or serve in the Senate. And I'm particularly concerned about the loss of leadership in the United States Senate. Many, many people, and I'm certainly in this group, are very critical of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who seems to have abandoned the very critical goal of maintaining the institutional integrity of the United States Senate. The framers, as we've said before, established a system which rested on the strength and vitality of our governmental institutions. If those institutions should fail, then the Constitution fails, and then so too does American democracy. What we've seen emerge under the leadership or lack of leadership with Senator McConnell, I think, is the emergence of parliamentary government. Because the senator seems to simply be doing the bidding of President Trump, and McConnell himself has said that he's not willing to present any bill or idea to the president which the president disagrees with. Thus, we find ourselves resembling the English parliamentary system in which a prime minister governs the country. These circumstances represent precisely the circumstances which led the framers of our Constitution to reject parliamentary government. That is to say, because they'd already decided on the separation of powers, they could not possibly create a parliamentary system because it was impossible to mesh the two. But now we see an exercise in the impossible, with McConnell abandoning the institutional integrity of the Senate, caving into the president, forgetting that, in fact, the Senate is one half of the first branch of government. Why is he doing that, you ask, or you might ask? Because he is principally concerned about his political standing and the political standing of his party. He believes that, in fact, if Republicans were to turn their backs on the president, then he believes the president would be so weakened that it would effectively weaken the Republican Party for years to come and really hurt their chances in 2020. I think that's the raw politics of it. It's hard for me, as an advocate of institutionalism for many years, to understand that the leader of the Senate could sell out the Senate. Party politics often carries the day, and it even overwhelms institutional integrity. And let me just say, on a bipartisan note, even though McConnell's actions have gone to the extreme, it's not simply been Republicans who have abandoned the institutional integrity of the Senate. For many, many years, both Republicans and Democrats have abandoned their institutional powers, for example, by surrendering powers in the area of national security and war-making and foreign policy. George Mitchell, the former Senate Majority Leader, a man whom many admired, simply abandoned the responsibility of the Senate when Bill Clinton was president, even though he had vigorously defended the congressional authority over the war power when, in fact, Bush was president. But as soon as Clinton became president, George Mitchell said, well, of course the president has the authority to decide to take the nation into war. That kind of flip-flopping, or let's use the word hypocrisy, fails to uphold the institutional powers of the various branches of government. So that's a grave problem that we're facing. How to breed institutionalism in America, how to persuade members of Congress in particular that their first responsibility is to their institution. James Madison addressed this in the Federalist Papers. In Federalist 51, he explained that in order to establish and to maintain governmental accountability, not only would we rely on the people, but we would rely on separation of powers and checks and balances. And the founders could not have imagined that members of Congress would surrender their authority, that they would abandon their institutional responsibility. It was simply not a matter that could have been comprehended by the framers because that was the backbone of our system. But we've seen it over time, beginning particularly with foreign affairs and now in domestic affairs. We wonder, how do we regain institutionalism? I think that the answer to that question lies with the American people. And that is, the American people have to say to their representatives, now when you go to Congress, be sure to look at the Constitution, study the powers that are granted, the powers, duties, and responsibilities that are vested in the House and the Senate, and you take an oath to uphold the Constitution. That means that you exercise the lion's share of foreign policy powers. You own the war power. You have a vast array of national security powers, and you have these powers and responsibilities in domestic affairs. And as Madison himself would say to the American people, if you don't hold your governmental officials accountable and insist on adherence to these institutional responsibilities, then you have nobody to blame but yourselves. Now, that may strike many citizens as a tall order, but it can be accomplished. When representatives return to the district and they hold town hall meetings, if they hold town hall meetings, then it's your responsibility, I would say, to stand up, to speak to Democrats if you're a Democrat, to speak to Republicans if you're a Republican, and say you are failing to carry out your duties. You have no right, it's not within your discretionary authority to abandon your constitutional responsibilities just because it's better for you politically. Because the Constitution was not written for the Senate or the House, the Constitution was written for the American people. You're elected to uphold those constitutional duties, and we expect you to take the oath of office seriously. And if you're not willing to do that, you should resign your office. And if they're not willing to uphold those duties and they won't resign, then you need to find a better candidate to remove them from office. Because, as Madison said in Federalist 51, who has a greater interest in maintaining the constitutional republic than we, the people, ourselves? So, to the extent that we give certain members of Congress a pass and say, well, they have an out here because they do good work for us on these domestic policies, so we'll overlook their constitutional failures over here. To the extent that we give them that pass, then we need to take the blame for some of the loss of institutional integrity. And that applies to liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans. If we want a republic, then we have to fight for it. If we believe it's not worth fighting for, then we can surrender ourselves to executive ascendancy, to a president that has now gone beyond the imperial presidency, and we can acquiesce in the face of a Congress which has for a long time abdicated its essential responsibilities and duties. It harkens back to what Jefferson and the founders said about the need to hold government accountable. Americans are very busy. A lot of Americans are indifferent to this responsibility to hold government accountable. But certainly few governmental officials are going to bother to hold themselves accountable to the Constitution and the people, because their great ambition is to try to achieve their policy ends. And if they can do it by skirting constitutional restraints and institutional responsibilities, you can bet by golly that they're going to do that. Please, yeah, please, Jim. Can we come forward over here to Jim Francis, please, Kelly?
I can speak really loud.
But we want the world to know, because this is on radio.
All right. So yes, what I'm, this is kind of a follow-up to what you just said, and I'm wondering, as you were speaking, that is part of the blame on us because we are judging our political leaders on what they brought to our state? And is that what the founding fathers were thinking? Were they thinking, oh, we elected somebody from a state, we want them to do things for us and our state? Mm-hmm. Or were the founding fathers thinking, well, they would all work for the national interests?
Excellent question. The short and clear answer is that James Madison wrote in the Federalist Papers that congressional representatives' first duty is to pursue and to promote the national interest, even if it means sacrificing the state interest. And that can put politicians, that can put a member of Congress in a precarious position, because we have a history full of representatives in the House and the Senate, including representatives from Idaho, who failed in the minds of the public to promote the state's interest, and therefore they were defeated. But Madison's philosophy has a real logic to it, because the founders believed that as a nation, as a United States of America, we could identify certain national interests. The public good could be apparent, and everybody needed to work toward those, even if members of Congress had to sacrifice their state interests or their regional or sectional interests, whether it involved economics or other policies. Otherwise, as Madison explained, we would be breeding sectionalism in the country. And of course, we saw the horrors of sectionalism and regionalism in the rise of the Civil War. That's exactly what happened. And so Madison's wisdom on this point, reflecting the views of his founders, could not have been more clear. But so often we find, as you point out, that in fact, representatives from states believe that it's their duty to promote state interests. So how do we dissuade them of that duty? Here again, it comes back to the public. We, the people, need to better understand how our system's supposed to work. We should summon the courage to address our representatives and say, in fact, your duty in going to Washington is to promote the national interest, not your state interest. If, in fact, Americans all over the country fail to do that, then we not only are surrendering to state interest and regionalism, but we're providing a foundation for the continuation of the assertion by representatives of their state interest or regional interest, because if a few representatives, even a few, say, my duty, from my view, is to promote the interest of Alabama or Idaho or Arkansas or New York, then other members are going to say, well, I'm not going to sacrifice or risk my political career in the name of the national interest. I want to stay here. I want to stay in Washington because I believe I have the goods, or I believe there are important policies to fight for. They're not going to do it. And it only takes a few more then before everybody says, my goal, my responsibility is to promote state interests. So this comes back to the subject of civic education. We need more civic education so that people better understand how the Constitution allocates powers, how the three branches of government are expected to carry out their responsibilities, duties, and powers, and fundamentally, why the American people have the duty and responsibility to hold governmental officials accountable. Now, if we cannot achieve that through civic education, and we cannot instill in the American body politic this civic virtue, and we cannot reverse the tide in which people serving in Washington for 10, 25, 30 years to promote their own self-interest in the name of state interest, then we've got to look for more radical reforms. I'll talk about some of these next week. I hope you'll come back so you can hear my ideas. But it may mean that we have to look, for example, at term limits. It may mean other strong mechanisms that can, in fact, impose the less than desirable restraints on representatives who are indifferent to their constitutional responsibilities and duties. But fundamentally, we cannot ignore the duty that we all have to speak out to defend this constitutional allocation of power and to insist on accountability of the government to the governed. That line, that rhetoric, and it's more than rhetoric, that principled position is as old as the Republic, echoed by people on both the right and the left for centuries. Kelly, another question? Right up here, please. Yeah. Great. Thank you. And then behind you. Thanks.
Hi there. So you've touched on it every week about the local representation of the voters by our elected officials. And that their responsibilities are to the people that have voted in, though you just stated that their primary focus should be for the national good, not specifically to the people that voted for them. But I'm going back to you also keep making mention to the parties. And I guess I'll put my tin foil hat on at the moment and say I believe that that's kind of one of the problems. It seems like we have these local people. They are elected either under a Democrat or a Republican hat. And then the party seems to control them because the party controls the candidates that we actually get to see, the candidates we potentially get to vote for. And then they, in my opinion and observation, appear to hold them hostage to following the party line, Democrat or Republican. And basically, if you don't follow our rules, you won't get our help in fundraising. You won't make the connections to the money to allow yourself to be reelected. And then you mentioned term limits. And it seems to me that enacting term limits would, I think, go a long ways, and I'm curious of your opinion, would go a long ways to putting the power back of the people. It would require the local parties, the state parties, the national parties to go find those candidates, to find those people that wanted to represent the government, to find those statesmen, gentlemen earlier stated. And I'm curious how you feel about that.
Thank you. All of those are good questions and strong points. And we could talk about those for hours. So if we take first the issue of party control, we would recognize that at least in the scholarly literature, for 100 years, people have debated the pros and cons of a strong versus a weak party system. And in at some junctures, people are touting the virtues of a strong party system because it's the way we can get things done in Congress, for example. But on the other hand, people at particular points in time, the Watergate class, or even more recently, have complained about the tyranny of the powerful party leaders. And so, because they do, exactly as you say, control the allocation of campaign finance money and the positions on committees and your roles and opportunities in Congress. So as with all issues we find in the literature of academics, that we find pros and cons on whether the party system has been too strong, too weak. But we could talk about that at length, but that would be the conclusion. On the issue of term limits, I have found myself flirting with term limits about every other week. So that is to say, I recognize the virtues and warts of it. And is this unlike a lot of political issues? No issue or no position on an issue is pluperfect. We find some weaknesses. We have some strengths. The virtue of term limits is, A, it would deprive somebody of running who simply wants to line his pockets, try to promote a particular ideology, earn a pension, because you would only be able to serve whatever the limit is, one or two terms. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to find altruistic people who are running, because people, organizations with big money are still going to be looking for candidates who will promote their particular issues. But we would also see that it would be very difficult for people to continue to promote a particular line with any effectiveness if, in fact, we put a ceiling. So when we look at and there are more pros and cons, but if we look at the ultimate baseline of term limits, given the fact that longevity represents at least as much harm as it does good to the system, on balance, that inclines me to now embrace the concept of term limits. Because it would have, as the latter part of your question indicated, it would have the virtue of suggesting to people, other people, uninvolved, that they have the opportunity now to run for office and that they should become more engaged in politics. I've never seen an indispensable member of Congress. We've had some very fine members. There's no doubt about that. But in fact, nobody's been indispensable. And we look at this on the margins, and we might say, well, we already have term limits, which is the usual response to those who advocate term limits through a constitutional amendment. That is true, except the ability of the people to make a clear choice has been corrupted by the large role of money. And so that means that, in my view, if we're going to introduce term limits, then I sincerely want campaign finance reform. I want publicly financed campaigns. I want to eliminate the role of private money. And yes, I realize there's a free speech element to this, but the Supreme Court has said, of course, A, that all speech is limited, somewhat conditioned by the pressures on society or the harms or the evils that confront society through speech. And secondly, as Justice Stevens wrote very persuasively, that in fact campaign contributions partake more of a matter of property than speech. And in any case, however you view that, we can still limit speech. And I think if we look at the harm caused by the role of private money, I think that the argument is persuasive that we should have publicly financed campaigns, because that would put candidates on a more or less equal level and allow we, the voters, to better assess the qualifications of candidates for office and make a choice that is not so tipped or, let's say, tainted by money. So that's my short answer to your question. I don't want to take everything that I'm going to talk about next week, the other 15 reforms that I'll talk about next week. Yeah. Please, we have where are we? Oh, right here's the mic. Yeah, please.
I had a question actually following along what qualities you want to search for in a candidate. Yeah. And I was wondering, so in the list that you were talking about all the qualities that previous leaders have had, do you think there is something missing? Because the sample size that you've had, it's probably were American leaders that were majorly male. So if we think about a quality of, I don't know, caring, something that you started off your talk with, well, love doesn't rule the world, but what if it did?
Yeah.
What if a person that was loving was right now ruling and would care about the people that are not working, not getting salary?
Yeah.
So how do we get those qualities? Should they be in something alternative to what has been around? How can we get them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So the first thing is, it's very clear that we need a lot more women in positions of power. There's been a lot said about the way in which women address issues and challenges through a more collective decision-making approach than men. So there's a lot to suggest that we could be better off if in fact we took advantage of the many talented women in this country and had them assume positions of responsibility. We're still trying to overcome the effects of sexism. That's very clear. Every time a woman seeks high office, we are reminded in a very difficult way of the sexism that still pervades our system. Think about how people always wondered, well, what's Hillary Clinton wearing today? She's wearing a dress, a skirt, pants, always to focus on her looks, her appearance, which we don't do with men. The analysis of her use of language to indicate whether she's more feminine or not, is she strong or weak? We don't do that with men. So we need a lot of education to reach that point where we can say we have achieved gender equality. But think about this, and I always love this remark from Warren Buffett, who said a few years ago, look at what this country's achieved, the remarkable things we've achieved, and we've only used 50% of our population. How about we utilize the other half of the population? Yeah, absolutely. So the Alturas Institute is an advocate for gender equality. We hold programs throughout the year to promote that. And so defeating sexism and gender inequality is a very important issue. You ask, what if love ruled? I would like to say that love makes government go. Well, there is some truth to that because we didn't have enough time for me to go into this, so let me take 2 more hours to go down this path. That, in fact, those who have been very successful leaders in promoting democratic values and principles have been those very people who have compassion, who have exhibited compassion for the people in our nation who have been the have-nots. Those people who have wanted to fight poverty, for example, those people who sought to emancipate slaves, those people who have sought to liberate women and other minorities, those who have sought to make education affordable, those who have fought to beat back the isms, racism, sexism, you name it. So that is exactly what your point is. It reflects the compassion that our great leaders have had for the American people, and their successes have contributed mightily to the advancement of democracy. So whether we're talking about Lincoln in the Emancipation Proclamation, whether we're talking about the war on poverty, whether we're talking about trying to fashion equal voting rights for others, all of those points of compassion have served to promote democratic principles. So I think there's a lot of value in what you say. Thank you. Next time I give this talk, I won't say leadership makes the world go round. I'll say love makes the world go round. Thank you. Where are you, Kelly? Back there. So we've got a question here. Kelly, you're getting your 10,000 steps in just tonight. Thank you. Yes, please.
Well, I really don't have a question. I have an observation.
Oh, great.
And my observation is that if you look at the makeup of the House and the Senate now, as compared to what it was, let's say, 20 years ago. And there's a lot more ethnic diversity, and there's a lot more women. And I think that, at least in this time and day and time, that I think the women are going to make the difference. So we need to get more women in office, because I don't think they will be, I don't think they'll be influenced to the same degree that men will. I think they will stand up and take care of business.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's a great observation. I think that's very true. Borne out by recent history. I think that's right. Another question over here. Okay, a couple questions over here. Thank you.
Hi. I submit to you that there is another element to the qualities of leadership, which is the office itself. The presidency, as envisioned by George Washington, is very different from the presidency today. And part of it has been the creation of the influence of various people along the times who have gradually expanded, or should we say, raised the bar on what a president should be. One of the things that it requires is awareness of the majesty of the office, for example, not self-centeredness. So the question that I have for you is, how do we improve the discernment of the people so that they can choose better in whom they send to the White House to be the office of the president?
That's a very fine question. Thank you. It goes to the issue of reform. So let's note, we don't have a lot of time left, but let's note that what scholars have always said about the presidency is that the presidency ends up being occupied by the people, by the person whom the people prefer. That's what scholars have said for many years. But we now know that not to be true. Consider the last election. 3 million more people preferred Hillary Clinton to be president than Donald Trump. And that meant that we seated in the White House the silver medalist, not the gold medalist, right? So that goes to the issue, obviously, of how we elect presidents and how people work their way through the primaries and the caucuses to reach that stage where they can be the final candidates representing their party. So I'm a strong advocate of doing away with the Electoral College system. I do not think that it represents democratic principles. In fact, it's anti-democratic in nature. And while it had its purposes at the founding and for a good many years afterward, it's outlived its utility. The very rationales behind the creation of the Electoral College no longer obtain here in America. I'll talk about this more next week, particularly because we're about out of time. But in fact, one of the leading considerations behind the rejection of a popular vote and the embrace of the Electoral College was the founders' perception that Americans could not cast knowledgeable ballots for presidents because they would not have enough information about the candidates, surely a leading reason, that no longer applies. Right now we know everything we want to know about candidates, sometimes more than we care to know about the candidates. That reason no longer applies, but we've moved along in two centuries as America has become much more democratic. There's no longer a reason to maintain the Electoral College. We would be much better off if we had a direct popular vote. But your question also went to the issue of primaries and caucuses and how we reached the point of winnowing down this list of candidates to the final actors. The primaries are important, there's no doubt about that, and because we have to have a mechanism for selecting people. But here again, we have the problem of money, and money corrupts the primary process as well. And I'll share more views on that next week, which means you have to come back if you want to hear, if you care to hear my thoughts about that. Thank you. Well, one more question, and where are we? Yes, please.
This is related to what you've already talked about, but when the pollsters come around and start asking people, who do you prefer as a candidate, they start with name recognition. And who can get name recognition unless you're already wealthy or you're already an office holder, or maybe you're a reality TV show person, or, you know, some gimmick that gets your name in front of the public. People who are not already well known will have a real struggle against someone who has name recognition.
You know, that's an excellent point. There's no substitution for the value of name recognition. There long ago was a movie starring Eddie Murphy, a comedy, and it's called The Distinguished Gentleman. And if any of you ever seen it, it's hilarious. So do yourselves a favor, rent it. If you don't like it, tell me, I'll give you your money back. But while it's a comedy and a great Eddie Murphy film, it has a very important message about the role of name recognition in American politics. It is king, just as you said. So here's the way that people get their names out there and they get recognized quickly. And that is that because we have multiple cable outlets now providing talk shows and commentary, anybody who runs now can get that attention. They can get their names out. All they have to do is go give a speech somewhere, and unless you're in Idaho, and you give a speech in another state, and you'll get instant recognition. So that's, while I'm generally critical of all of the multiple shows and their devotion to something other than good public discussion of issues, that is an advantage now of social media and all of these shows. People can get their names out. Your central point is absolutely true. I agree with you that there is no substitution for great wealth in the political system as it currently stands. It's hard to outdo a candidate who has wealth. And that's why, for example, somebody like Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, who's talked about running an independent candidate, or depending on the week, maybe as a Democrat. Once upon a time, he was a Republican. He could. Or Howard Schultz, who is being urged by people to run as an independent or a Democrat. If you have billions of dollars in a capitalistic economy, you certainly can acquire that name recognition. If you don't have that wealth, you don't have that natural advantage. But fortunately, you still can get attention if you simply make an announcement speech and the media members are there to cover it. So you can do it. But it won't be an equal playing field. You're certainly right about that. I agree, and that bothers me a lot. How are we doing? Kelly, where are you? Okay, let's have, I guess right here, two more quick questions, and then we'll wrap it up, please. Okay. What's that?
The question's quick, the answer may not be.
Oh, no, the answers can be very quick.
Do you want to go to him first?
30 words or less.
Go ahead.
Please, thank you. There we go.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, student, great. Thank you, students, for coming out tonight. Let's give a round of applause to our students. Please.
So you mentioned getting rid of the Electoral College. I was wondering what would prevent candidates from going to the most populated areas like New York and Los Angeles, and how would you combat that?
Yes, excellent question, and I will talk about that a little bit more in depth next week. The fact is there's no denying that candidates are going to go where the voters are, in the same way that hunters go where the ducks are, right? The only difference is that if we abandon the Electoral College, then in those relatively close elections, candidates would go to small states which they might not otherwise visit. And that would be Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, et cetera. So we might get visits. Sometimes people say, well, they would never visit our states. Well, how often do the candidates visit our states now, right? So, but the bigger question is, in fact, how is it that we're going to elect the President of the United States? Should it be through an artificial mechanism which no longer reflects democratic principles, or should it be through a more democratic process? And if we argue against a democratic process, then we have to ask ourselves, why do we want to curtail democracy? Why do we want to elect a president through a mechanism that is not applied to the election of any other officer at any other level? But you raise a very important point. We'll address that a little bit more next week. Thank you. Kelly, where are we now? Who has a question? She did. She asked your question. That's how good that question was.
There you go.
So, okay, one last question then.
I just wanted to make a comment about the press. And when we talk about, you know, political parties or how do we promote a candidate or how do you get recognition, it's not only money, but it's also the role of the press. Because there are candidates, if you look at the Green Party or look at some of the smaller parties, you don't hear about them. You know, and if you really look at the last election, you know, it was who is the press putting forward? So I wonder if you could just comment on that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. In fact, the decision made by the press to cover particular candidates is an editorial decision. And if, in fact, editors decide we're not going to cover a candidate from the Green Party because that person doesn't have a chance of winning, then that's unfortunate, at least until it's already been determined that there are two or three front runners and the race is virtually over. I would say to the press that at the beginning of a race, that the press owes coverage to those candidates who have even a modicum of serious support and a chance of winning. You don't have to necessarily cover the kooks, and there are a good many of those who run for office. You don't have that obligation because you have to make a decision about what's newsworthy and who's newsworthy. But I don't like the fact that the press might choose not to cover some candidates based on an editorial bias against a particular ideology. But as I say, I think it's the case now that people running for office can make an announcement that they're running for the House or they're running for the Senate, and in fact they can get a lot of coverage. And sometimes the press can play an important role in examining the early credentials of a candidate. Let me give you an example from my former life when I was a reporter. One day a man came in and wanted to talk to me, saying he was going to run for president of the United States. Now, it's not often that I had somebody come in when I was a reporter and inform me. And you never know. You don't know if they're a kook, and I didn't know this guy. On the other hand, everything's possible until it's not. So as that gentleman sat down with me and started talking, I'm looking at him, and I'm wondering, how old are you? And I asked him, you know, sir, how old are you? Because, you know, you have to be 35 years old to be president. And that's when he said, well, I'm 33, but I have connections. I'm connected with the Marshall Field family in Chicago, and they can pull strings. And that's what I was looking for, the quickest way to get him out of my office. So you never know, but you shouldn't make judgments too early. Otherwise, you might not have a story, right? So thank you all for coming. Thanks for your great questions. And let's see. And Jamin informs me that tonight's lecture will air on March 11 at 7 p.m. on KSU. And thanks to KISU for broadcasting this election. Thank you. See you next week. Thank you.